Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday, April the 7th, these are our main stories. Two Israeli women have been shot dead in the occupied West Bank just hours after Israeli airstrikes on Lebanon and Gaza. We get analysis from our Middle East editor. Talks between Russia and Turkey's foreign ministers fail to reach agreement on extending a deal to allow vital grain shipments to leave Ukrainian ports.
We proposed extending this deal only for 60 days, based on the fact that if there is no further progress in removing obstacles to the export of Russian fertilisers and grain, well, then we will think about whether this deal is necessary.
And why are Zimbabwean medics leaving their homeland in droves? Also in this podcast, Northern Ireland marks 25 years of peace. A mother and daughter reunion across the barricades of North and South Korea. And
maybe some shamans or religious specialists, if you prefer, were the ones who manipulate the drugs and who control their effect.
Researchers uncover evidence that people were taking mind-altering drugs in Spain 3,000 years ago. We begin in the Middle East, where this year's rare convergence of religious holidays, Passover, Ramadan and Easter, has not brought a break from violence. Quite the opposite, in fact. The past few days have seen clashes between Israeli police and Palestinians at the Aqsa Mosque compound in Jerusalem and cross-border attacks from Gaza and, more rarely, southern Lebanon. In response, Israeli warplanes struck targets in Gaza and Lebanon overnight. And now, as we record this edition of the Global News Podcast, Israeli troops in the occupied West Bank are searching for suspects involved in the killing of two Israeli women in the area. Our Jerusalem correspondent Yoland Nell reports.
When it came, Israel's promised retaliation hit the Gaza Strip hard. The military says it struck targets linked to the Palestinian militant group Hamas. It blames Hamas, which governs here, of not only firing rockets at Israel from Gaza, but also for yesterday's barrage launched from Lebanon. Overnight, there were more Gazan rockets, most intercepted by Israel's defence system. And this morning, after the bombardment, Palestinians spoke of a frightening night.
My daughters were crying, and one fainted. That's what happened. I looked around and everything was destroyed. I checked my vehicle and it was destroyed.
In Lebanon too, locals inspected the damage after three Israeli strikes near a Palestinian refugee camp. This was one of over 30 rockets fired from Lebanon a day ago. Israel brought down most of the barrage. In its response, it's been wary of drawing in powerful Lebanese militants. This week, violent scenes inside Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque caused outrage across the Middle East during the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. Israeli police said they raided the prayer hall after what they called agitators barricaded themselves inside. Palestinians threw fireworks and distressing videos emerged on social media showing officers beating people in the mosque. Today, thousands of Muslims headed to Friday prayers at Al-Aqsa. It's often a flashpoint for troubles. The third holiest place in Islam is also the holiest place for Jews, who call it Temple Mount and celebrate Passover this week. Nearby in the Old City, Christians from around the world joined the Easter Good Friday procession.
As the three religions which hold this ancient city sacred mark their own holidays, tensions remain dangerously high. And once again, there's been proof that what happens here can quickly have an impact across the wider region.
Yoland Nell reporting. So how serious is this latest spiral of violence? A question for our international editor, Jeremy Bowen.
I think it's very serious. It's not just serious because of the individual gravity of each incident, which is serious enough. It's serious because It comes after really quite a protracted period of growing tension, not just between Palestinians and Israelis, but because of other factors working in the region as well. So put it all together, it's the result, I think, of a lot of these forces coming together, which point to the intractability of the conflict and the lack of hope of any kind of resolution.
Let's have a look at the Lebanon factor. Who are the Palestinian factions there? How are they connected to Hezbollah, to Hamas in Gaza? How can you enlighten us?
Well, there are quite a lot of Palestinians who live in Lebanon. These are descendants of the refugees who were expelled from Israel in 1948. Most of them live in camps. And the same organizations that are active in the occupied territories, the West Bank, Gaza, are also active in those camps, including Hamas. So they haven't claimed any sense of responsibility. The Israelis have said that they did it. And the Israelis, when they retaliated, it was to Hamas targets in Lebanon, but also in Gaza as well. So they see it as all much for muchness. However, there's bigger stuff happening there. The real force in the land is Hezbollah, which is the militia and political movement, which is really more powerful than the government and is very close to Iran. Now, if these rockets were fired from South Lebanon, that's the real stronghold of Hezbollah, and they would not have been fired, I would say, without the say-so of Hezbollah. Now, would Hezbollah want to escalate things? I think no, not at the moment. Neither Israel nor the Lebanese militia want to do that, because I think they know that if war did start between them, as it did in 2006, it would be extremely damaging. Hezbollah have got more than 100,000 rockets, according to estimates, and the Israelis, too, have been planning for such a conflict.
Jeremy Bowen talking to my colleague James Kumarasamy. Last month, Russia agreed to extend by 60 days a deal with the United Nations and Turkey to allow the export of Ukrainian grain through a safe corridor in the Black Sea. Today, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov met his Turkish counterpart Mevlüt Çavuşoğlu in Ankara to discuss another extension and failed to do so. This was Mr. Lavrov's reaction at a news conference after the talks.
We proposed extending this deal only for 60 days, based on the fact that if there is no further progress in removing obstacles to the export of Russian fertilizers and grain, well, then we will think about whether this deal is necessary.
Our Europe regional editor Danny Eberhardt told me what was at stake.
Well, Russia sees agreements that were drawn up and brokered by Turkey and the United Nations in July as a package. It's referring to a memorandum of understanding that was signed at the same time as the basic grain deal that talks about liberalising the export of grains and fertilisers from Russia. And it says that the terms of the agreement have not been implemented. Now, there isn't sanctions on exports of Russian grain or fertilisers, other than some bilateral ones, for example, stopping potash being exported into the EU, but not to the wider world. But Russia says that such shipments are still being impeded by a consequence of other sanctions. So, for example, stopping some of Russia's banks from accessing the SWIFT financial messaging system that's used worldwide, also problems with shipping insurance, this sort of thing. So that's Russia's position. It wants movement on that, and until it sees that, it won't extend the deal, which is now due to run out in mid-May.
And Mr. Lavrov repeated Russia's conditions for peace in Ukraine.
Yes, he did. He largely repeated Russia's positions. Basically, he said that, you know, any peace talks, there is no prospect at the moment of peace talks, I hasten to add, but any peace talks need to focus on what he called the new world order. This is Russia's attempt to frame the Ukraine war as an anti-colonial war, which is extraordinary for people within Ukraine and in the Western alliance, because they say actually what Russia is doing is fighting a colonial war in Ukraine. It's trying to bring a former Soviet country back into Russia's orbit when Ukraine doesn't want to do that. So there, several of these arguments have been used throughout the war, they've had some play in some parts of the world where there are concerns about colonialism. So in some areas of Africa and Asia and Latin America, they're widely discredited in other parts of the world. So it's going to be interesting to see basically how much play these Russian arguments get. But Turkey, at least in terms of the export of fertilisers and grains, said that the obstacles that Russia faces needs to be removed in order to secure an extension, which is important basically for ensuring world grain prices don't rise to the levels we saw last year.
Danny Eberhardt. Two of the most incendiary issues in the United States, race and gun control, have come together in the state of Tennessee after the Republican-dominated state house expelled two African-American Democrats who led a protest in the chamber calling for stricter gun laws. It followed days of pro-gun control demonstrations in the wake of last month's deadly shooting at an elementary school in Nashville. Before the vote to expel him, one of the Democrats, Justin Jones, addressed the House in a speech that went viral.
Just yesterday, the House Speaker took to national news to condemn us and call for expulsion before any evidence was presented, before any trial happened. And so what we see today is just a spectacle. What we see today is a lynch mob assembled to not lynch me, but our democratic process. But it will not stand because no lie can live forever.
A third Democrat, a white woman called Gloria Johnson, joined them on the House floor chanting, "No action, no peace." Though she was the only one not to be expelled, Republicans insist the decision was not racially motivated. Justin Jones spoke to the BBC's Sumi Somaskander as he packed up his office.
They've shut off my ID badge already, so they shut off my access to the building. I had to get another former colleague to let me in. And they shut off my email access, and so I'm no longer a legislator. And that means that the 78,000 people from District 52 have no representation in the state of Tennessee. 78,000 voters, I represent the most diverse district in the state of Tennessee, and now they are left without a voice because of the decision of an extreme Republican supermajority, which is almost completely a white caucus, expelling the two youngest black lawmakers because we stood demanding action on gun violence.
Justin, you expected Republican lawmakers to take action. Are you surprised that they voted to expel you and your fellow lawmaker?
I think the nation and the world are surprised and should be shocked because what they said is that democracy does not matter in Tennessee. And they took a very extreme step. There's only been three expulsions in the House in Tennessee history, all involving crimes or unethical behavior. This is the first expulsion for First Amendment activity for a breach of decorum. They said violating decorum rules. Even members who've been here, former members I've talked to, no one has ever heard of a breach of decorum rule resulting in expulsion. It's the most extreme measure because it doesn't only silence us, but it's really about silencing our district.
So I want to ask you about what Republican lawmakers have said, because they have said that you broke rules of decorum and staged a mutiny. Did you and your fellow lawmaker take it a step too far?
No, I mean, we have spent the whole session being silent, not able to speak. And so what led up to this point was that whole week, again, I represent a part of Nashville, a community that is mourning, a community that is traumatized. We couldn't even talk about the issue of gun violence because this legislature was passing laws to arm teachers, to make it easier to get a gun than it is to vote or to get health care. This is a very uniquely American problem.
Justin Jones speaking to Sumi Somaskander. Usually Ibiza is the first place to spring to mind when people discuss drugs and parties on Spanish islands. But now it seems that Ibiza may be a bit late to that particular party. About 3,000 years late, in fact, because researchers in Spain have discovered evidence that people were getting high on hallucinogenic drugs at a site on the island of Menorca that was used for 600 years, until 800 BC. The lead archaeologist on the project, Dr. Elisa Guerra Dulce, told me more.
Well, I have been looking for evidence, archaeological evidence for drug use for many years, but we didn't have direct evidence of this practice till now.
But you found very, very, very old and rather disgusting-looking human hair.
Well, not disgusting. For archaeologists, it's quite surprising and extraordinary because in European history, it's not very usual to find human hair.
But studying this, we'll agree to disagree on whether it's disgusting or not, but studying this human hair yielded some incredible results, actually.
Yes, that's right, because human hair samples are one of the best ways to detect the consumption of drugs. So we were very lucky to find these human hairs dated to the late Bronze Age And also, of course, very lucky to detect the presence of three different alkaloids.
So what do you think that these people were using drugs for?
Well, in this case, we do not rule out the use of drug plants for their medicinal purposes, but we also think that they use them for religious practices because there's evidence which indicates that maybe some shamans or religious specialists, if you prefer, were the ones who manipulate the drugs and who control their effects.
So they were getting high. What were the effects, do you think?
Two different effects, because the brands were different as well. The joint pipe, the one containing ephedrine, is like a natural stimulant. And the other two alkaloids coming from different botanical plant species belonging to the nightshade family have hallucinogenic properties.
Dr. Elisa Guerra-Dulce. Now, before we move on, a word about this weekend's Happy Pod from Andrew Peach.
Yes, you'll have heard on the Global News podcast about the BBC's new education programme aimed at girls and boys who can't go to school in Afghanistan. We're going to bring you some of the reaction we've had from families there in the first few days. We love hearing the sounds that make listeners happy. Alex has been in touch from New Zealand to share a recording of him meeting his birth father for the first time. We've got the first new cheetah cubs in India for 70 years, Salma in Finland, who's a taekwondo black belt at the age of 82, and who let the dogs in to a museum in Greece. All in the Happy Pod, an extra edition of the Global News podcast in this feed from Saturday.
Still to come, a noisy rooster stirs up a Good Friday rumpus in Nigeria.
Lives Less Ordinary is the podcast from the BBC World Service that seeks out extraordinary stories from around the globe.
I'm in a trench in Ukraine with shells flying overhead, petrified.
It's a window into other people's worlds.
It can't be separated from the addictive nature of my personality.
And it's available now.
Feeling incredibly alive when death was at its closest.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
If you're a regular listener to the Global News Pod, you'll be all too aware that Zimbabweans have been buffeted by harsh economic headwinds for more years than you'd care to keep track of. Life is hard, jobs scarce, inflation officially hovering about 100%, although unofficially it is much, much higher, absurd. One way out for those with the right skills is emigration, seeking work in more stable, wealthier countries. But it's leading to a severe shortage of healthcare workers in Zimbabwe itself. In the past year alone, 4,000 nurses and doctors have left. The president of the Zimbabwe Nurses Association, Enoch Dongo, told us why.
What is happening is, looking at nurses in Zimbabwe, the salaries that they are getting are maximum $300 to $400. And this is not enough. Looking at the cost of living in the country, you need to pay rentals, you need transport from home to work, you also need to take your children to school. The second issue is the working conditions, where you find out that in the hospitals, there are no resources, there are no drugs, there are no surgical centers, there are no modern equipment, the buildings are dilapidated, and all this makes the environment not conducive for the nurses as compared to neighboring countries and as well as in Europe, for example. You know, the quality of life that they are living in Zimbabwe is different from other countries.
To combat that, the Vice President of Zimbabwe, Constantino Chiwenga, who's also the Health Minister, has announced that the government intends to introduce a law that would make it illegal for other countries to recruit Zimbabwe's health workers. Our correspondent in the capital, Harare, Shingai Nyoka, told us more about it.
Zimbabwe is one of 50 or so countries on the World Health Organization's so-called red list of countries that are facing critical health shortages. It recommends that ideally a country should have a doctor for 1,000 patients. In Zimbabwe, we understand that ratio is one doctor to about 12,000 patients, and there are two nurses for every 1,000 people. At one point, I did a story last year about the exodus of nurses and doctors. And at that time, about a quarter of the local clinics had scaled down or shut because so many of the staff were leaving. The ones that were open were operating at about 50% capacity, with nurses running different departments at the same time. And they said they were stressed, overworked, and they kept resigning. You speak to the statistics that about 4,000 health workers resigned from the public service. Many of them went abroad. And in one of the recent UK government reports, Zimbabweans received the fourth highest number of skilled work visas in the UK, above countries like the USA. In 2019, the UK gave out 500 visas to Zimbabweans. Last year, they gave out 8,000 visas. So that really gives you a sense of the scale of the problem.
Now, the government's saying because there are big shortages like what you've described, and they have no choice but to ban foreign recruitment. How is this going to work in practice?
It's very difficult to say. This was an off-the-cuff remark by the vice president, who is also the health minister. So it's difficult to predict how they plan to tackle it and whether it is possible to put in place a law that will ban international recruitments. The World Health Organization, by placing Zimbabwe on the red list, already offers some level of protection. What the UK, for example, has now done recently is that they say that Zimbabwe is now one of the countries where no active recruitment can take place. But local authorities here say that it's impossible to stop people from applying for jobs to go overseas. So it's really difficult to see how they are going to tackle this.
Shinga Nyoka talking to Akwasi Sarpong. And we stay on health briefly with the latest evidence on the initial outbreak more than 3 years ago of COVID-19. A research team in China has published its analysis of samples taken from the market which has repeatedly been linked to the outbreak, which eventually led to the global pandemic. The Huanan Seafood and Wildlife Market has been a focal point in the search for the origins of the coronavirus. Victoria Gill has more details.
With many early cases of the virus linked to a seafood and wildlife market in Wuhan, the Chinese Centers for Disease Control took samples from surfaces, cages and stalls there. Now, analysis of what those samples revealed shows that DNA from wild animals that were for sale in the market was found in locations that tested positive for the virus. Other scientists who've examined these genetic clues say that an infected mammal, possibly a raccoon dog, could have been the source of the initial spillover of the disease from an animal to a human. But the Chinese team point out that their findings fall short of definitive proof of how the pandemic started.
Victoria Gill. It's a big weekend in Northern Ireland, the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement that brought an end to the conflict between Britain and the IRA. Though today is Good Friday, the vagaries of the calendar mean the actual anniversary falls on Monday of next week. 25 years ago, though, in the hours before agreement was reached, the peace negotiations were at a delicate phase. As well as all the Irish players, President Clinton and the then British Prime Minister Tony Blair were involved in the complex talks. Our Ireland correspondent Chris Page has been speaking to many of the surviving key negotiators. He has the story of the pivotal 24 hours which led to the agreement.
In the final few hours before the deadline, the Ulster Unionist leader David Trimble was driven past demonstrators outside his party headquarters. Inside, he faced more opposition from his own members. He didn't want him to do a deal involving the political wing of the IRA. His colleague, Lord MP, recounts what happened.
There were a lot of very hurt people in that room, people who had lost friends, people who had been blown up, had lost limbs, people who had had their property attacked or relatives killed, were part of the community, part of our party. And while there was vocal opposition raised, it was clear that there was a majority in the room to proceed.
Back at Stormont, some divisions were deepening, but others were disappearing. There was a breakthrough overnight on the issue of a power-sharing regional government. However, another matter was drenched in moral jeopardy. Bertie Ahern was the leader of the Irish government.
We always accepted that
you were not going to get an agreement from either Sinn Féin or from the Loyalist Group that abandoned the prisoners. The question is, how could you do it and, you know, not lose public opinion?
But the talking continued and news reports were positive.
Change times at Stormont. It was a successful night and an emotional morning.
That's fine. I was going to start crying. Thank you.
President Clinton's role was hugely important, according to Breeze Rogers from the Nationalist SDLP.
If it hadn't been for Clinton in the last 24 hours before the Good Friday Agreement, I don't think we would have got it. He was in touch, he was phoning, he was a very clever statesman, if you like, but he recognised Trimble's difficulties, he recognised the Sinn Féin difficulties, and therefore he was able to talk to them. On Friday morning, we were all delighted because we thought we were nearly there, you know, and suddenly we got word that the unionists couldn't agree. It was a hold your breath moment, really, for about a number of hours.
The Ulster Unionist Party was at a pivot point. It wanted a firmer commitment that paramilitaries would decommission their weapons. Tony Blair tried to reassure David Trimble with a letter.
While the Ulster Unionist delegation were discussing that on the Friday afternoon, I mean, did it feel like everything was just hanging in the balance? You couldn't be sure what way it was going to go.
I thought maybe we have lost it. But then I gave the additional commitment to the unionists, and, you know, we and this is where David Trimble, you know, did exercise real leadership.
I'm pleased to announce that the two governments and the political parties of Northern Ireland have reached agreement.
This was one of those very few moments in politics where, you know, it's a moment of pretty much unalloyed joy. So it's there weren't many of those, I can tell you.
The legacy is that we got peace and we stopped the killing. So we've had our day. It's for another generation of politicians to build on that and to move it forward.
The then leader of the Irish government, Bertie Ahern, ending that report by Chris Page. To Nigeria now, where a noisy rooster has fallen foul, of the law in the northern city of Kano. Neighbours had complained that the birds' incessant calls were keeping them awake at night and took their case to a judge. Summoned to court, the owner said he'd bought the rooster for a Good Friday family treat. The BBC's Mansour Abubakar is in Kano and told us how the story unfolded. And a warning for lovers of our feathered friends, it doesn't have a happy ending.
When Malam Isiakudi, one of the rooster, was summoned, he immediately accepted that, yes, he and the rooster were in the wrong. And he said he bought it for the Good Friday celebrations and he's going to slaughter it. That's today. So the judge, Justice Halima Wali, told him that, okay, since you already have plans for Good Friday, I think we're going to enforce that. Make sure you slaughter it on Good Friday so that the neighbors can get good night's rest. The rooster has been taken care of. He said he has secluded it in a good place.
Taken care of, that's, I fear, a euphemism. We end this edition with a story of resistance, resilience and love. Escaping from North Korea has always been a dangerous and difficult mission. In recent years, it's got even tougher as the country's leader, Kim Jong-un, has boosted security along the border and imposed ever harsher punishments on those who try to escape. Last year, a mere 67 people managed to flee to South Korea. 17-year-old Song Mi made that journey, a young woman on a mission to find the mother who'd left her behind in North Korea when she herself had fled to the south. 14 years after they were separated, mother and daughter were finally reunited. Our Seoul correspondent, Jean McKenzie, has been to meet them and told Akwasi Sarpong what she'd found.
As we know, North Korea is one of the most repressive dictatorships in the world. And it's incredibly hard to know what's happening there because the government largely makes it so hard for people to leave. People are actually not allowed to escape North Korea. And if they get caught, they could be killed. So last year here in South Korea, I actually got to know this young woman, Song Mi Park, who just had the most remarkable escape story. And it really highlights, I think, just how hard it is to escape from North Korea and the sort of agonizing decisions that people must make, which is why we decided that this was such an important story to tell. So Song Mi was 4 years old when her parents first tried to escape North Korea. She was strapped to her mother's chest as they waded through the river that separates North Korea from China, which is how most people managed to escape. But they got caught and they were sent to prison. And her father died. So when her mother was released from prison, she decided to escape again, but this time alone. Now, initially, Songmi was living with her grandparents, but soon they died. So Songmi was essentially alone, aged 10, having to fend for herself in North Korea.
I had no money, nothing. I made a living by foraging for herbs in the mountains and selling them. I was just trying to survive for the day without starving to death. When I was 11, I decided I would escape to see my mother no matter what. Before you cross the river, you're supposed to be scared. The river is deep and the current is strong. I could have died. But the thought of getting to my mother felt like I was throwing away a heavy burden and flying away.
17-year-old Songmi there. So how did they come to be reunited, Jean?
So even though Songmi says there that she was 11 when she decided she wanted to escape, it would actually take her many more years because Songmi's mother had managed to get to South Korea. And after many years, she was able to wire her daughter some money she'd saved. So with this money, Songmi could then plan her own escape. But it took her about a year to get across the river to China again. And then she had to wind her way through China in secret and into Laos. And then from Laos, she could travel on to South Korea, where she could reunite with her mother. And I was able to ask her what it was like at that moment where they reunited.
I didn't get a chance to see her grow up, so I just thought this must be my daughter, since she was standing in front of me. I just hugged her and said, "You've been through a lot to get here. Well done."
So this separation and reconciliation must have been incredibly traumatic for both of them, mother and daughter, presumably in something that they will have to work through emotionally.
Yeah, they're having to build this relationship from scratch because really they haven't seen each other since Songmi was 4 years old. And one of the things I really wanted to understand was why her mother decided to leave her behind.
I was 9 when you came back from prison. Why did you escape then?
I wanted to bring you with me at first, but the broker said no children. If we got caught, both of us would have suffered again. So I asked your grandparents to watch you for a year, but much more time has passed.
I see.
What would you like to say to your daughter?
I want to say that I didn't abandon you. I made a choice to leave first to give you a better life.
Byung-Hoo Park talking there to our correspondent in Seoul, Jean McKenzie. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Sam Dickinson and the producer was Mark Duff. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.